Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, a bomb kills two Indian soldiers as voting begins in Bihar. Students in Taiwan end their sit-in at Parliament. And new research proves that ancient shrimp in China had hearts. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. A bomb set off by suspected Maoist rebels killed two Indian soldiers and wounded at least three as voting got underway in eastern India's Bihar state. Authorities say a jeep carrying the soldiers to a polling station drove over a landmine in the Munger district. Maoist insurgents have urged voters to stay away from the polls and threatened to disrupt the election. Today's voting is the third stage of Indian parliamentary elections, which are spread out over a month to give hundreds of millions of voters the chance to cast ballots. Voting commenced in India's capital, New Delhi. Neighboring states of Haryana and some parts of northern Uttar Pradesh province, along with several regions in the east and south. The Hindu Nationalist Opposition Party, BJP, is looking to push out the Congress Party after a decade in power, promising to revitalize a stagnant economy. Outgoing Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has said it would be a disaster if the BJP's Narendra Modi becomes the new prime minister. India's Supreme Court cleared Modi of charges of helping to instigate anti-Muslim riots in Gujarat in 2002, killing around 1,000 people. The United States canceled his visa. Elsewhere in South Asia, Afghanistan's presidential ballot last Saturday has been widely hailed as a triumph for the people. But Sharon Bain reports from Islamabad that with votes still being counted, hopes for a smooth end to the election are beginning to fade as candidates appear to maneuver for a political fight to the finish.
The vote results for a new president of Afghanistan are not in yet, but already the two top rivals among the candidates are each claiming a win. Technocrat Ashraf Ghani, a former World Bank official, told media he is certain he received a majority of the votes, given the turnout in areas where he gathered a lot of support. His chief competitor, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah, has said he is sure that 60% of the voters had cast their ballots for him. To win the election, a candidate needs 50% plus one vote. If no one reaches that threshold, there will be a runoff. Omar Samad, an Afghan expert at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., says it's likely that the front runners will fight to the finish.
They have indicated that they will go all the way because both of them are in favor of a stronger mandate by going to the end of the second round.
Samad adds that the other six candidates could soon start negotiating, throwing their support behind one of the two assumed leading candidates. Partial results could be announced as early as the end of this week. The final tally is not expected until mid-May. Ahmad Yusuf Nuristani, the head of the Independent Election Commission, called on the candidates to wait for the official announcement of the vote results. He says his request to all the candidates and people of Afghanistan is to avoid predictions or publishing numbers so as to not confuse people. Let the Independent Election Commission announce the results as scheduled, he says. According to the National Democratic Institute, a full accounting of all ballots will be particularly important in this hotly contested election, where the margin of victory is expected to be slim. Jandad Spingar, executive director of the Free and Fair Election Foundation of Afghanistan, says so far the effective security efforts and higher than expected voter turnout has lent huge credibility to the election. He says all the ballots must be counted and complaints of fraud or vote rigging must be resolved before a final count can be released.
Then we can say that we will have complete legitimate election and the result will be acceptable. If there will be second round, so we can expect that before second round there will be a kind of negotiation between two candidates.
According to FIFA, its election monitors observed 2,600 cases of fraud and misconduct. Afghanistan's senior electoral officer, Zulhaq Amarkel, has said every documented election complaint would be investigated. He says Afghans are holding elections under conditions of war and insecurity. But, he says, if there's any credible evidence showing that someone interfered with the documents in favor or against any candidate, the Independent Election Commission wants to assure the nation that it takes all such complaints seriously and is ready to deal with the situations. Analyst Samad says the election's overall credibility will depend heavily on how the Election and Complaints Commissions perform their jobs. The Asian Networks for Free Elections Foundation warned in a statement Wednesday that candidates' premature and unfounded declarations of victory can create an unrealistic expectation among supporters. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, the Chinese premier calls for more cooperation and free trade in Asia. In Taiwan, student protesters ended their three-week occupation of the legislature today. The protest was sparked by a controversial cross-strait service trade agreement with mainland China that opponents fear will cost jobs and invite Chinese encroachment on the island. Dozens of protesters dismantled chairs used as barricades, took down posters, and packed up sleeping bags after seizing the chamber March 18th. Speaking on a webcast Wednesday from Taipei, Taiwan's president, Ma Ying-jeou, who advocates closer ties with Beijing, says the proposed agreement is actually part of a broader economic cooperation framework agreement reached in 2010. He says Taiwan's services sector exports lag behind those of Singapore, South Korea, and Hong Kong. Mr. Ma of the ruling Kuomintang Party endorsed a concession made earlier by the parliament speaker to end the student sit-in to enact a law to require greater parliamentary oversight of future such agreements with China. The Taiwan leader referred to an inexplicable fear on the island of too much dependence on mainland China. Mr. Ma also insists that while Taiwan's exports to the world have risen since he took office in 2008, the percentage going to China over the past 5 years has declined, a sign his administration is diversifying its trade with other countries. He says while the mainland remains Taiwan's number one trading partner, Taipei is not putting all its eggs in one basket. Bill Sharp, East Asian Studies professor at the Hawaii Pacific University, was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty why the measure is so controversial.
It's essentially seen as an attempt at creating legislation that is going to be railroaded through what they call the Lifa Yuan or the legislature. This bill has been going on for a while. It's been contentious all the way. The Kuomintang wanted very, very little discussion, if any, and wanted to pass the bill almost in a railroading-type fashion, completely void of all transparency. And the students took obvious umbrage at that. Their problem was that, hey, look, the unemployment rate in Taiwan by Taiwan standards is high, 4.5%. People are very nervous about that, especially university students wondering where they're going to get jobs upon graduation. Their position was that if Taiwan's market is open to these small and medium-sized enterprises from the mainland, that this is going to take more job opportunities away from them. The student movement is receiving very wide public support. But the public support comes from maybe not so much like students' interest about jobs, but popular support about concern for becoming too dependent on mainland China. And it is exactly the small and medium-sized enterprises that feel that they will be the biggest losers in this, that the mainland will be able to flood Taiwan with all kinds of resources to the detriment of Taiwan's small and medium-sized businesses.
You have a landmark economic cooperation agreement between China and Taiwan signed, agreed to in 2010. How's that doing?
It's true that at least initially Taiwan received lots of benefits from that. They certainly appreciate the economic benefits, but they're getting increasingly wary about the political ramifications. I mean, I think it's very clear to people in Taiwan, especially people that think about this kind of thing, that the mainland's long-term game is unification of Taiwan with China. And this is just one ploy in that process. And people know that. People in Taiwan are sort of taking advantage of the economic benefits, but they don't really have any interest in uniting with the mainland. These are two very different societies. And frankly, in my view, they don't go very well together.
Bill Sharp of the Hawaii Pacific University. The RAND Corporation's Scott Harrell says the protest in Parliament is just the latest political setback for the Ma administration.
In particular, one could note some land seizures in the area of Dapu, the mishandling of the death of Corporal Hong, a soldier in the Taiwanese military who was basically killed by some incompetent management during training exercises. There has simply been a perception that the Ma government does not listen to and does not respect those who have a difference of opinion on policy with it. And so I think the risk is at least fairly substantial that President Ma's current position, including the statements at CSIS, that he will continue to push for this deal and that the opposition to this deal is simply out of ignorance or out of a backward-looking approach to economic development, I think that those perspectives are unlikely to help resolve this issue. What we've seen in Taiwan over the last 3 weeks has been a real galvanizing of popular opinion across the island in favor of the students and critical of the Ma government's handling of this particular instance of public activism. And in fact, that's even cascaded into divisions within the Kuomintang, or the ruling KMT party, where leading public officials from New Taipei City, Taipei, and Taichung, where the KMT has three mayoralties, those leading officials, all of whom are potential contenders in 2016 to be the standard bearer for the party for the next presidential run, have all taken a different stance than the Ma government. The final thing to say is this is really about more than just an economic issue or mishandling or misgovernance by the Ma administration. It's also about the role of China and whether or not Chinese strategy is to absorb Taiwanese society and Taiwan's economy through these kinds of arrangements. There's an inherent skepticism of Ma because many Taiwanese believe that Ma views himself first and foremost as a Chinese and as someone whose historic mission is to reunify with the mainland. And that's simply not a perspective that holds a lot of water with large numbers of people in Taiwan. And so there's this aspect of anxiety about China's intention and Ma's reliability there, too.
Well, how's this going to redound to his party coming up with those elections in 2 years?
Well, you know, in fact, I should highlight that it's not just elections in 2 years. There are elections for the seven major expanded municipalities across the island later this year. So we will get a look at the impact of this dispute later this year. And I think right now, at least, the latest polls that I have seen suggest that there has been a very dramatic erosion of public support for and trust in the ruling KMT or Kuomintang party, and a consequent, although not totally synonymous, move for support over to the opposition Democratic Progressive Party. There is a real challenge here for the opposition party, the DPP. They need to be very careful not to mishandle this protest. They have not always been at the forefront of opposing the trade deals in every respect, but they do have an opportunity here to synchronize their positions to some extent with that of the student leadership and also try to give expression to that concern that the student leadership has put out there. And if they can do that, they can really capitalize on this and put forward a platform that shows how their party would differ from the ruling KMT, then they could potentially take the mayoralty elections late this year and use that as a springboard to 2016.
Scott Harold of the RAND Corporation. He says while the ruling party likely has the votes to approve the services trade pact, it may have to open it up to opposition input and revision ahead of a final vote. Anything less, Harold said, could result in further protests. Taiwan expert Bruce Jacobs of Monash University was asked by Victor Beattie if the student protesters achieved their objectives during the three-week sit-in.
They achieved a lot of things. My own feeling was they presented better than either the ruling Kuomintang or the opposition Democratic Progressive Party. I thought they really presented as intelligent, cautious people who, in a sense, were looking for the best wishes for Taiwan and not for selfish interests. They were very impressive. We'll still have to see what happens down the line, but I think they did achieve what they wanted. And the Minister of Justice now has said something really stupid. I mean, the students have worked really hard to take care of the legislature, and they're cleaning it up, and, they're spending a lot of money. And there's still the Minister of Justice said when they come out, these two leaders are going to have to serve sentences up to 7 or 10 years, which strikes me as that's not a way to solve a problem.
Will this service sector trade agreement pass the legislature?
I think it may pass, but in a revised form.
What kind of revisions do you anticipate?
Fields that are opened up to both sides for services are not equal. From a Taiwan perspective, some of the places in China that are open are only in Fujian province, where in Taiwan they're open for the whole place. There's other things like one of the areas which is to be opened up is the publishing industry. Now, everyone knows that publishing in China is extraordinarily controlled, and it's not controlled in Taiwan. So the situations are very, very different.
Is Mr. Ma's party, the ruling party, in electoral trouble with elections later this year and also in 2016?
Yes, it's in huge trouble, at least for the local elections. Mr. Ma himself has an approval rating of about 9%.
Has this three-week student protest strained Taiwan-China relations?
It's hard to be sure. If China's relations with Taiwan look closer, it's because China allows it. If they look more distant, it's because China is the one that's sending negative signals. So both sides of politics in Taiwan would like to have close relations with China. And as President Ma said last night, in fact, trade with China increased a great deal under the Democratic Progressive Party government of Chen Shui-bian. Both sides of politics would like to have good, peaceful relations with China, but neither side of politics wants China to rule them. Taiwan is an independent country, and it doesn't need China coming and say, you belong to us.
That's Bruce Jacobs of Monash University. As the global economy continues to struggle to recover, Asia remains a bright spot, with developing countries still enjoying high rates of growth. Today, at an international economic meeting in China, the country's premier said that regional integration is the way forward for the sake of the global economy and despite regional frictions over territory. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong.
Li Keqiang addressed an audience of businessmen and politicians from over 50 Asian countries at the opening ceremony of the Boao Forum, a regional economic meeting modeled after the World Economic Forum. In his remarks, Li stressed the need for more cooperation and trade between countries in Asia. He says that in the past decade, intra-regional trade in Asia has expanded from 1 trillion to 3 trillion. Its share in total trade for Asian countries has increased from 30 to 50%. That is still far less than trade within the European Union, he says. China has been lobbying for more infrastructure projects to connect the country with its neighbors to the south and west. While physical transportation and energy links will help trade, China is also promoting the establishment of free trade zones to lure service and financial sector companies. At home, Shanghai was designated as a pilot city in free trade last year. Since then, dozens of other cities have filed applications to create a similar scheme. A regional free trade zone set up by the United States called Trans-Pacific Partnership has so far excluded China, which is seen as not meeting the requirements of free market, labor guarantees, and environmental protection. On Thursday, Li Keqiang said that China takes an open position to the TPP.
China's 跨太平洋战略经济
As long as the TPP is conducive to global trade and an equitable and open trading environment, he says, China is happy to see its conclusion. Li Keqiang's remarks come as China is experiencing a period of slowing economic growth. The leadership has committed itself to a radical overhaul of its economy towards a more market-oriented system. Analysts have noted that the types of reforms China is trying to implement at home are in line with the goals of regional trade pacts, such as the TPP. Li Gangliu is an economist at ANZ Bank in Hong Kong.
China would like to participate in the U.S.-led TPP process so as China will not be left out in one of the largest trade blocs in the future. So all that indicates China is determined to engage in fast economic reform and restructure.
Li Keqiang acknowledged the challenges of cooperating in a region where territorial disputes routinely disrupt other areas of cooperation. He repeated China's commitment to resolving disputes in peaceful manner, but said that China will respond firmly to provocations that undermine peace and stability in the South China Sea. Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong for VOA.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. From Asian waters comes news from more than 500 million years ago. An international research team has discovered the earliest known cardiovascular system, heart and blood vessels, in the fossil of a shrimp-like creature. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, the rare find sheds new light on the evolutionary timeline of life on Earth.
The Yunnan province in southwestern China is known for rich fossil deposits, but researchers had not expected a fossil so exquisitely preserved as this specimen of the 520 million year old shrimp-like species. Researcher Pei Yunchong with the Yunnan Laboratory for Paleobiology unearthed the fossil, and University of Arizona neuroscientist and team member Nicholas Strassfeld says it gave them the first detailed image of the creature's circulatory system.
It's a beautiful carbon trace. It is bilaterally symmetrical. It shows the dorsal blood vessel and the lateral vascular components, the arteries, the lateral arteries, and then a very, very beautiful system of arteries over where the brain sits in the head.
In earlier research with fossils of the same species, the scientists on this project had identified its brain, gut, and nervous system. Strassfeld says it's common to see fossils with imprints of teeth, shell, and bone, but not soft tissues because they decay first when a creature dies. He explains how the internal organs, like those the team describes in the journal Nature Communications, may have fossilized.
We assume that the specimens became entombed by a very sudden event, a sudden burial, maybe an underwater landslide, maybe something to do with a tsunami, who knows? Maybe a very, very heavy dust fallout from a storm. And then this chemical preservation of the internal tissue as it was squashed flat.
This ancient marine species dates from the Cambrian period, a time in Earth's history when major animal groups began to appear with a huge variety of shapes and forms. Strassfeld says the organ systems detailed in this study are easily recognizable in today's crustaceans.
It suggests that already 525 million years ago, the basic layout, the ground, what we call the ground pattern of, say, a vascular system, had already evolved. And the ground pattern persists until this day in modified forms.
If we see this ancient shrimp as modern, then Strassfeld asks, who was the ancestor that gave rise to its sophisticated and very elaborate set of organs?
This is not going to be easy because we don't really have access to any older deposits. So what we hope to find in these Changchang deposits in China are fossils of organisms that clearly were already ancient by that time. And that might give us a lead into how these more elaborate systems, these very recognizable elaborate systems, how these systems may be originated.
You can check out the internal organs of this half-billion-year-old invertebrate for yourself at voanews.com. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Roseanne, and thank you for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yockey.